French President Emmanuel Macron has reached the 100-day mark of his second term, and the contrast with the bold newcomer of 2017 couldn't be more different. Macron is being described as distant, burnt out, weary, and hesitant, but the adjective he may like the least is powerless. 2 months into his new mandate, Macron experienced his worst failure as a politician. His young political party failed to win a parliamentary majority. A president used to ignoring the legislative branch so far hasn't shown much political skill or interest in the tough work of cobbling together successful majorities to get his policies approved. Many believe Macron may call for new elections as early as this year or rule even more often by executive decree. Both options are sure to create major opposition in a new parliament as well as social unrest.
Since the legislative elections, France is in a new political era dominated by uncertainty. Macron has been acting as if he can easily find a majority in parliament on a bill-by-bill basis, but I think that has very little chance to work. It's very likely that in less than a year he'll dissolve parliament and call for new legislative elections.
Polls show that, unlike most winners of presidential elections, Macron has not benefited from the usual honeymoon or grace period. Just like in 2017, Macron was mainly elected to block the far right. But he's no longer a political unknown without a track record. Instead, he's a polarizing figure who has been tarnished worldwide by his authoritarian repression of the Yellow Vest protest movement, and who is perceived domestically as wanting very different things than the average person. Economic stagnation is already upon the Eurozone, and depression could be next. Political stagnation appears to have taken root in France, with perhaps even a depressed president. 100 days into Macron's second term, it's a summer of silent discontent in France, with possibly explosive autumn unrest looming. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Black-clad mourners beating on their chests and listening to elegies in honor of a man who lived 14 centuries ago but continues to touch the hearts of Muslims. Mass processions are underway in Iran to mark the martyrdom anniversary of the third Shia imam, Imam Hussein. Iranians from all walks of life have been participating in the ceremonies to pay respect to their imam.
The love of Ashura's philosophy should be gathered and extended in around the world. I believe that because it's not just the love for Muslims or for specifically Shias, I believe it's a love that everyone can learn and everyone can understand, because it's not just a matter of your religion, it's a matter of a man that sacrificed everything in his path for his beliefs.
Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Imam Hussein was a true freedom seeker who stood against the unjust and corrupt ruler of his time, Yazid. We as Muslims remember him every year to safeguard what our Imam stood for.
Imam Hussein was the grandson of Prophet Muhammad. Based on Islamic references, the Shia Imam and 72 of his companions were killed in the lunar month of Muharram in 680 AD in modern-day Iraqi city of Karbala by the forces of the second Umayyad Caliph Yazid. The asymmetrical battle was triggered after Imam Hussein refused to pay allegiance to Yazid, for he believed that the Caliph did not exercise true Islam as taught by the Prophet.
The philosophy of Imam Hussein's uprising was to expose the corruption that was entrenched in the ruling system. It was only after Yazid's troops spilled the blood of Imam Hussein when people realized Yazid's animosity toward Islam. And that set the start of the collapse of the Umayyad dynasty.
People believe Imam Hussein's sacrifices saved Islam from distortion and manipulation by Yazid. And this is just one reason why his love hasn't died down in the hearts of Muslims after 14 centuries.
Shia Muslims never miss out on the 10-day mourning ceremonies for Imam Hussein. They say these rituals are meant to keep Imam Hussein's flag aloft and preserve his legacy for the generations to come. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Pakistan! Imran!
Hundreds of supporters and lawmakers of the Pakistani Tehreek-e-Insaf party has filled the streets of the capital Islamabad in a show of support for the ousted premier Imran Khan. They marched in Islamabad's red zone to protest the recent verdict issued by the country's electoral body that declared Khan's party has received illegal funds from foreign individuals and entities.
The charged protesters are not only demanding that Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif and his cabinet step down, but also warning the United States to stay away from Pakistan's internal affairs.
The demonstrators criticized the role of Washington in Pakistan's politics, saying they are seeking independent foreign policy in Pakistan.
What they are doing to us with the drone attacks, the army men who are killed in our country, they just went for the, you know, the relief work, and after that the plane was crashed. It is just, I would say, it's you know, they're intervening in our country.
With the USA, some black sheep from Pakistan, they were also involved into all this procedure. That's why the real hero of Pakistan, Imran Khan, has to resign from his office. And now the question is why? Because Imran Khan, he said absolutely not to all their illegal and to all their unfair demands.
While addressing the protesters, Khan underlined that a fresh election is the only way to get rid of what he called the puppet regime.
The US staged a scripted drama for their own benefit in Pakistan, like to Pakistan and its foreign policy. So fresh elections are the only solution to get rid of this government.
On the other hand, the Pakistani government has filed a disqualification reference in Election Commission against Imran Khan. The government demands that the electoral body impose a lifetime ban on former premier as well as his political party. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Iran's defense ministry has held an exhibition on its capabilities in knowledge-based production and economy. The event covers such fields as transportation, health and medical equipment, security, energy, information and communication technology, cyberspace, construction and mining, industry, petrochemicals, food security and agriculture, as well as household appliances, electronic parts and geographic data and information. In general, 1,100 products in various fields have been put on display at the exhibition.
The ministry's management team has been cooperating with more than 6,000 knowledge-based companies. The localization of products, expanding in-depth knowledge and technology, and creating synergy among the relevant institutions are on the ministry's agenda. The Defense Ministry is responsible for empowering and upgrading Iran's defense industry capabilities while using its knowledge to contribute to production of non-military products.
Iran has repeatedly voiced its readiness to provide advanced scientific and military technologies to friendly and neighboring states. Because it has already achieved self-sufficiency and scientific capabilities in the field of military power and manufacturing state-of-the-art, weaponry.
Holding such exhibitions will provide an opportunity to learn more about the potential and capacities of the private, knowledge-based companies and make use of their potentials for defense-related productions.
Meanwhile, Iran's defense minister has announced that in the coming days, his ministry would unveil a series of new defensive achievements.
According to Iranian officials, as a result of cooperation between Iran's defense ministry and knowledge-based companies, the capacity of the ministry for production has increased by over 20 times in the past couple of years. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Leading analysts gathered in Seoul, South Korea, and remotely from the United States to discuss North Korea's nuclear weapons program and the potential crisis should Pyongyang conduct a seventh nuclear test. Some admitted past strategies had failed and argued that North Korea's security concerns needed more attention and consideration.
We need to somehow address DPRK's strong motives for going nuclear. But what we did against DPRK was only strengthening DPRK's incentives to go nuclear.
North Korea suspended its nuclear and long-range missile testing following a 2018 summit between leader Kim Jong-un and former U.S. President Donald Trump. Now, years later, the U.S.-led sanctions Pyongyang had hoped to see removed remain in place. The discussion of North Korea's nuclear program comes as new South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol implements a more hardline approach to Pyongyang. President Yoon has called for the South's military to develop preemptive strike capabilities against the North as part of a so-called kill chain military strategy. President Yoon has also moved to restart suspended large-scale joint military exercises with the U.S., a move that Pyongyang has previously viewed as a provocation of war. The drills are scheduled to take place later this month. Meanwhile, many analysts believe such an approach will lead to greater tension.
The only way to address the risks of accident, misperception, or miscalculation is to try to manage deterrence through risk reduction. Limitations on military exercises, cessation of missile testing, force exclusion zones around the DMZ, sort of a mix of steps that both North Korea and South Korea and the United States would take in the conventional and strategic areas.
Experts also suggest a failure to reduce risks may encourage both South Korea and Japan to develop nuclear weapons themselves. Frank Smith, Seoul.
It took the Election Commission of Pakistan 7 years to conclude the illegal funding case against the party of former Prime Minister Imran Khan. The case that was filed by one of the founding members of Khan's Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf party maintained that his party received illegal funds from foreign individuals and entities. In a 70-page judgment, the Election Commission confirmed that Tehreek-e-Insaf was guilty and concealed 16 bank accounts through which it accepted donations from foreigners or foreign groups.
I thank God that our 8-year struggle has paid off. I have no personal interest in this case. This is in the national interest that Pakistani political parties and their leadership must be subservient to the law.
The Election Commission also ruled that the former Prime Minister submitted false statements regarding his party's funding, but the party of Imran Khan has dismissed the charges.
We have been saying all along that this is not a case of foreign funding, but prohibited funding. Today's ruling has vindicated our stance that our political party has received no foreign funding.
The ruling comes over 3 months after Khan lost his office in a vote of no confidence in April. But Khan still insists he was ousted from power through a U.S.-backed conspiracy.
Was there any crisis in the country when the U.S. toppled our government? And those responsible in Pakistan to stop this conspiracy have acted as mere spectators.
Despite being ousted from power, Khan's popularity has increased. This was reflected in by-elections held recently in Punjab, where Khan's party swept the polls. The unexpected victory by Khan's party has allowed them to regain control of Punjab province.
There is no immediate fallout of the Election Commission's ruling on Khan and his party. Nevertheless, findings of the Election Commission may lead to legal challenges for the former Prime Minister. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Over the past few decades, China and the United States have been on the collision course on various issues, ranging from trade, human rights, Hong Kong, Taiwan, the South China Sea, to the COVID-19 outbreak. The already tense relation has soured further with a controversial visit by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan, a self-ruled island Beijing considers as part of its territory. Pelosi made a one-day trip to Taiwan during her ongoing East Asia tour despite repeated warnings from Beijing that such a move could embolden pro-independence forces there. She used an Air Force plane to get to Taiwan, while over a dozen American fighter jets kept an eye on her. Upon arrival, Pelosi defended the controversial visit.
Our delegation's visit to Taiwan honors America's unwavering commitment to supporting Taiwan's vibrant democracy.
During her trip, Pelosi met with Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen. She was also awarded the highest civilian award as a, quote, symbol of America's strong and enduring friendship with the island. In response to the visit, Beijing has announced military drills, including a series of live fire maneuvers around Taiwan, including in the strategic Taiwan Strait. Taipei has reacted angrily, saying the drills and encircling of the island by Chinese forces are similar to an invasion. Beijing has also put curbs on some imports from Taiwan, while halting sand shipments to the island.
This is a complete farce. The United States is violating China's sovereignty under the guise of so-called democracy. Those who offend China will be punished. Those who play with fire will not come to a good end.
Pelosi has already concluded her trip to Taiwan, but it seems to have negative and far-reaching consequences for the island and the U.S., as Beijing has described Washington's action as extremely dangerous. Taiwan is not the only irritant issue in ties between Beijing and Washington. The U.S. is missing no chance to pit regional countries against China, whether there is a maritime dispute or other bilateral issues. The reality is that there are several economic, political, and strategic issues involved in U.S. policies in Asia-Pacific. One can also not ignore the constant U.S. meddling under the pretext of security amid rising China's influence. It's too early to say that China and the U.S. may engage in an open conflict. But with ever-increasing frictions and the continued U.S. meddling, it seems that the strained ties between the two are very unlikely to ease anytime soon.
The top prize of the Islamic Human Rights Awards goes to Shirin Abu Akla. The former Al Jazeera journalist was shot dead by Israeli forces back in May while reporting Tel Aviv's atrocities against Palestinians. Her name echoed in the seventh edition of Islamic Human Rights and Dignity Awards. Shirin was awarded for her vital role in shining a light on the Palestinian cause in her on-the-scene reports from the occupied territories.
Shirin was killed by an Israeli bullet. There's also criticism directed at the U.S. Israel is pushing the United States to avoid introducing the Tel Aviv regime as the killer of Shirin Abu Akleh. But we at Al Jazeera will continue our investigation of the case to bring her assassin to justice.
Another winner of the Islamic Human Rights Awards was Mandla Mandela, the grandson of former South African President Nelson Mandela. Mandla, who is now serving as a member of South Africa's National Assembly, won the award for his active role in opposing the Israeli occupation of Palestine.
The Palestinian issue is of greatest importance to us, as we have seen the atrocities that are being meted out against defenseless children, women who are languishing in Israeli jails, as well as Palestinians in general. And we continue to expose the apartheid regime of Israel as carrying out crimes against humanity and genocide against the Palestinian people.
Organized by the Iranian Judiciary's Human Rights Committee, the event was held on the occasion of the 32nd anniversary of the Cairo Declaration of Human Rights in Islam. In 1990, member states of the Organization of the Islamic Conference assembled in Cairo and laid out a new human rights charter that sought to ensure man's freedom and right to dignity in accordance with Islamic laws.
Activists here say the Cairo Declaration of Human Rights states that every human being, regardless of race and religion, has the right to a dignified life, something which they say the West has so far not lived up to.
Observers say the West, and on top of them the U.S., maintains a selective approach toward human rights, to an extent that it violates even its own principles of human rights.
For example, you see that in Canada, how they are treating the indigenous people. They are their own people, and their rights are violated. Or in the United States, so you see that how they are treating with the blacks. So they are also, again, their own people. So for them, it doesn't matter whether it is Islamic human rights or the international human rights or the Western human rights principles.
The imposition of sanctions as a punishing leverage is another example cited by participants here as a blatant violation of human rights by Washington.
The sanctions that have been imposed on the Islamic Republic are secondary sanctions imposed by the United States, not by the United Nations. South Africa itself does not observe these sanctions. We don't recognize them.
Participants say the Islamic narrative of human rights is not meant to be a counterpoint to the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but it seeks to safeguard the rights of Muslims against any misuse by countries such as the U.S., which looks at the issue through the lens of its political interests. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate. Thank you.
the Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. The Gaza Strip has once again come under Israeli attack with the regime warplanes launching a wave of airstrikes across the besieged Palestinian territory. Several people, including a five-year-old girl, have been killed and scores more have been injured. The Palestinian resistance movement, Islamic Jihad, says one of its senior commanders was killed in the airstrikes. Israel has launched several deadly wars on the blockaded strip, including one last year which killed nearly 250 Palestinians. While the international community remained silent over the atrocities, Islamic Jihad has pledged to target Tel Aviv and other Israeli cities with missiles in retaliation for the Friday airstrikes. Another Palestinian group, Hamas, has said that the Israeli regime bears responsibility for the consequences of its airstrikes. On tonight's Spotlight, we'll discuss the goals behind the new Israeli attacks and the response that Palestinians have vowed to give. Joining us on tonight's program, we have journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier, joining us from Marseille, France. And also we have historian journalist Brett Jonkers, who's joining us from Hasselt, Belgium. Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Magnier in Marseille. How do you view the timing of this recent raid by the Israelis?
Thank you for having me. This is not new for the apartheid regime. In 2012, the Israelis killed, three years ago, they killed Fatah, and today they have assassinated, again, the Syrian Jabari, a responsible in the jihad, in the Islamic Jihad. The reason why Israel feels free to do and to carry out assassination attacks is because it is not accountable and it had the full support of the United States of America, that the White House came out, as usual, saying Israel has a right to defend itself when Israel is the aggressor, when the Israelis are the one who started the assassination, while the Israelis have asked from Egypt to talk to the Palestinian groups about de-escalation and to bring down the level of tension in Palestine. So on one hand, the Israelis ask for a mediator from Egypt and Qatar to stop the tension and to reduce it and to make sure that there are no problems with the Palestinians. And on the other hand, it goes behind the mediation and kill and assassinate Palestinians and Palestinian leaders that fully aware that the Palestinian groups are going to retaliate. Now, well, this is not only a question of assassinating Palestinians. It is a question of siege against the Gaza. It's a siege against the fishermen, against the agriculture, against everybody who's living in Gaza and is not abiding by the Palestinian, by the Israeli occupation of Palestine.
Brett Jonkers, what do you think are the goals and objectives this time around coming from the Israeli regime? The Israelis are known for seeking instability across the region and with its neighbors, but what about this time? Is there more to it?
Well, actually, that's an interesting question because it just happened to be the case that today, actually, a few hours, I think it was around the noon, a few hours before the strikes started, the Jerusalem Post, one of the main media outlets in the Zionist entity, actually ran an article in which they claimed that the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement has, quote-unquote, changed the equation for the Zionist entity to what they call defend itself, and has basically changed things around in a way that Israel, that the Zionist settlers are living in a situation, or at least in a feeling of fear for a reckoning that they haven't felt in quite a while. According to the Jerusalem Post article, the Zionist entity had significantly reduced the fear of attack from Hamas in the past couple of years, especially since the 2021 attacks on Gaza. But now recently, now we saw after the arrest of Bassam al-Saadi in Jenin recently, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement, as what admitted by the Jerusalem Post, like once again, might I repeat, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement didn't have to fire a single shot, and yet the entire economy and the entire livelihood, let's say, of the southern parts of the Zionist entity, of all the border regions with Gaza, was basically kept at a standstill for several days because of the simple fact that the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement made what they call a credible threat to strike back for the arrest of Bassam al-Saadi. So just because of the fact that the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement threatened that they would strike, there was an almost complete shutdown of life among the settlements and among the Zionist colonists. All the border regions, anywhere even a little bit close to the Gaza Strip. And I think the reason why now there is such a show of force, why they specifically target, of course, a high-ranking figure in the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement, but then at the same time do it with such ferocity and such force that kills at least 10 people and wounds at least 55 more, it is basically it's a shock and terror sort of strike in which they hope, once again, the Zionists hope this way to basically relieve the stress and the fear that exists among their own population of settlers and colonists, and at the same time trying to, I think, hammer down against Gaza once again and hope that they could somehow militarily defeat the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement. Now, the reason why I don't believe this is going to work is exactly because of the fact that the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement has had such an effect already on the Zionist entity in the past week, despite the fact that they haven't even fired a single shot yet. At this moment, there hasn't even been a retaliation strike yet. And at this point, as was mentioned, now they are threatening to strike against Tel Aviv itself. So we will have to wait and see how they will run scared now over there in the capital, so-called capital of the Zionist entity, for even at areas far removed from the border, because they know right. that we are dealing now with a resistance movement that is not just tenacious and brave, but also has technologically advanced weaponry
sure.
at their disposal.
Elijah Magni, let's talk about the response of the Palestinian resistance groups. Islamic Jihad said Israel started the aggression and will have to pay the full price for carrying out these attacks. Hamas has also vowed to defend Gaza and defeat Israel. Will these Israeli crimes essentially make Palestinians more united in the face of the occupation? That's when we come to realize when Palestinian resistance groups say that these attacks were a miscalculation by the Israeli regime.
Sometimes it is not a miscalculation, because now the Israelis are facing an internal struggle domestically for the forthcoming elections. And the Yair Lapid, the prime minister, is showing that he can attack Gaza and he can assassinate Palestinians. However, you spoke about the unity among the Palestinians. Well, this unity is not new, because before the Islamic Jihad started to retaliate against the Israeli initiative of aggression and assassination, there was a meeting in the joint operational room among all the Palestinian groups, who all agreed that the Islamic Jihad would start retaliating by sending the first 100 rockets and missiles. And indeed, the Islamic Jihad hit Tel Aviv and other areas that were hit by a decision, a joint decision of all the Palestinian groups. So Israel is aware what is going to be the reaction from the Palestinian groups, because we've seen in the last battle of the Sword of Jerusalem how the United Palestinian groups all responded as one hand against the Israeli aggression. So the Israeli is really looking for trouble for domestic reason. And yet again, it is only the lack of accountability that allowed the Israelis to do what they have done. But the Palestinians have proven once more that the only choice they have is not the Madrid meeting summit, is not the Oslo agreement, but is the resistance against the Israeli regime that is always starting a battle or starting the assassination and looking for a war, because it's a society that is made of only belligerent and military, with a few civilians on the side.
Brecht Jonkers, talking about options that Palestinians have, many analysts say that resistance at this point is the most viable option for Palestinians. I want to know if you see it in that light as well, and how important is this this notion of consistent resistance?
I think it is of the utmost importance. It is vital for the very survival of Palestine as a nation, of the Palestinian as a people, and of Palestine as a country. If Palestine wants to survive and wants to continue surviving in the future, the only way that they can do this is through resistance. In fact, and unfortunately, the facts on the ground, reality has shown us what happens if you give up resistance, what happens when certain groups and certain parties, especially certain factions within the Fatah movement, have decided to give up resistance back in 1993 during with the Oslo Accords and then everything surrounding that, and trying to achieve a negotiated settlement according to these 1967 borders, as they call it. What we have seen is even if you were to accept the 1967 borders as legitimate, which they are not, because the borders of Palestine are the borders of 1948. They should be the borders of before the establishment of the Zionist entity. But that to decide, even when Palestine accepted the 1967 borders and accepted the independence only in East Jerusalem, in the West Bank, and in the Gaza Strip, this in and of itself was already immediately violated. This trust that was placed by people like Yasser Arafat in the word of the Zionists was immediately betrayed and immediately violated, with support from the United States, with support from Europe, when the Zionists immediately continued and restarted to colonize even the parts of Palestine that they themselves, the Zionists themselves, recognized as being Palestinian land. So when that was even before the significant rise of the extreme right-wing neo-fascist parties such as Likud and the other groups such as the politicians like Avigdor Lieberman and everything, who are now in power, who are even more rabid, who are even more extreme in their anti-Palestinian hatred. So faced with this, there are only two options, that is either resistance or extinction. And at this moment, the only thing that the Palestinians can do is, despite the many sacrifices that they have already had to make, and the sacrifices that will no doubt ensue still from further resistance, this is the only way in which they can survive and the only way they can avoid extinction.
Sure. Elijah Magnin, more reactions to today's attacks. Fatah has called for the international community to intervene to prevent the mass killings of Palestinians by Israel. Will the international community heed that call? What do you make overall of the international response to the Israeli crimes in the past?
Two things. First of all, Fatah has taken the wrong choice from the beginning by thinking it can rely on the Western community, and I don't use the word international community because there is no international community. There is only a Western community. Secondly, the Western community is not going to stand against Israel because it has never done that before, regardless the attacks and the aggression of Israel, not only against the Palestinians, but against Lebanon, against Syria, against Iraq. Israelis are taking always the initiative to attack under the pretext of self-defense. Well, this was an unprovoked attack, and they've killed a Palestinian leader today. Where is the Western community? The Western community, as the Americans express it always, asking everybody to calm down, to stop the conflict, because they are afraid of the reaction of the Palestinian resistance, because they are fully aware that the Palestinians have the right to defend themselves, and they will never get their land without an armed resistance, because all the plans, all the agreement that were run by the Western community have always failed and give not one inch to the Palestinians. On the contrary, Israel is taking every day, every week, more lands from the Palestinian territory under the impotent eyes of the Western community.
Brecht Jonkers, let's talk about Israeli impunity. As Mr. Magnier said, the Western community has never, most likely will never, stand against the Israelis. That means more impunity for the Israeli regime. They can get away with the crimes that they commit. How can the status quo ever change?
Well, by first and foremost, as has been mentioned before, the continuation of resistance, and at the moment what is already developing, has been developing for years now, the intensification of the resistance by the modernization of their equipment, by the strengthening of their arsenal, with support, of course, from countries such as Iran, countries such as Syria, that have been supporting the Palestinian resistance for decades. And secondly, by, as Mr. Magnier mentioned already, the fact that the Palestinian Authority, if you want to call them that, the government in Ramallah, the ones that call themselves the government of Palestine, they have to finally, completely and utterly look away from the West and rely on themselves and rely on the people who support Palestine completely. And this is the axis of resistance, first and foremost. This is by relying on Syria, this is by relying on Iran, by relying on Hezbollah, on Ansarallah, on Yemen, on Lebanon, and on the international anti-Zionist movement. And the international anti-Zionist movement is vast, and it is extremely diverse, and it goes far beyond countries that were just mentioned. Especially in the developing multipolar world that we see now, there is increasing support for Palestine, coming, for example, from Latin America, from Cuba, from Venezuela, from Nicaragua, and from Bolivia, and across the globe, even within the West itself, the general public opinion is very often sympathetic to the Palestinian cause. The only problem is that the Zionist lobby is so incredibly powerful that anyone who is even remotely in a position of power has to give up any sort of criticism of Israel, de facto. That is how it is, and that's how it has been for decades now. So the Palestinians can only, by relying on themselves, on the strength of their own hands and the strength of their own weaponry, and by the support of those who unconditionally support the liberation of Palestine, only by those two things combined can Palestine stand up for their own liberation, and can they finally come together and liberate the entirety of their land, either by forcing out the Zionists entirely or by forcing the Zionists to basically disband the Zionist structure as it exists now, and then negotiate for a possible coexistence, but in a united Palestinian state. Those are the only options that are left to them at this moment.
Right. Elijah Magnier, this is a question that's been coming up a lot recently. How do you explain this inconsistency that we're seeing on behalf of the international community's response to the Ukraine conflict and the seven-decade-old occupation of Palestine? Why hasn't Israel been sanctioned and pressured and shunned by the international community to end its occupation of Palestine?
Because Israel is protected by the United States of America, that has ruled the world since 1991, when the perestroika hit the Soviet Union, and it was the beginning of the U.S. unilateral hegemony of the world. And because Israel is a strategic ally of the United States, as the United States permit to itself to attack and kill people in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Syria, therefore, when the United States is responsible for over a few million people who were killed by the U.S. wars, the Americans are not going to stand for several thousand Palestinians killed by the Israelis, who are trying to imitate the same style and the same model of the Americans. And because the Americans are the rulers of the West, no Western country that call themselves the free world and they speak in the name of democracy and human rights, well, democracy and human rights disappear in this case when it is related to what the Israelis are doing. And here we're talking about all the target assassination that the Israelis carried out in Iran, in Palestine, in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, everywhere. The Israelis feel free because they are supported by the West, and the West offer them intelligence, passport, and all kinds of support so they can carry out their aggression throughout against all their targets that they think they represent a danger to their own security.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joining us from Marseille, France. And thanks to historian and journalist Brecht Jonkers joining us from Hasselt, Belgium. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
What is happening today in Muzaffarnagar is just as fundamentally a part of this phenomena as the ongoing repression and resistance in Sheikh Jarrah in Gaza and beyond, says Omar Zahza, member of the U.S. Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, in an article published under the heading Muzaffarnagar Evictions Enabled by British-born Judge. Stay tuned for more. Palestinians and their supporters, it is known as Muzaffarnagar. To the fake regime of Israel, and in keeping with the aseptic detachment common to colonial regimes, it has been firing zone 918 since 1981, when then Agriculture Minister Ariel Sharon decided on that designation explicitly in order to force out the area's residents. Located in South Al-Khalil Hills, the area spans 12 Palestinian villages with nearly 2,800 residents whose livelihoods depend mainly on farming. Agricultural communities have lived on the 8,600 acres of land and called it home for generations. In 1999, the Zionist regime's army expelled 700 residents of the area, though they were able to return pending a final ruling. This decades-old attempt at ethnic cleansing is now entering a crucial phase. On May 4th, the Zionist regime's High Court issued a ruling enabling the expulsion of nearly 1,200 Palestinians from the area, including 500 children, a decision the UN said may amount to a war crime. On June 1st, the Zionist regime forces demolished two homes in Khirbet al-Fakhit and two storage sheds, as well as two homes in Khirbet Markaz, both part of Muzaffarnagar. In all, 21 people, including 9 minors, were displaced. 11 homes and workshops have been demolished since May ruling. Muzaffarnagar puts on full naked display the cynical, oppressive, and overall colonial character of the ruling issued by David Mentz, a judge who lives in an illegal settlement in the West Bank, and the Zionist regime's actions. In the words of Nidal Yunus, head of the Muzaffarnagar Village Council, the ruling was simply racist. The court decision is a racist decision taken by a settler judge. We have been fighting with Israel in the courts for the last 22 years, and it took this judge 5 minutes to destroy the lives of 12 villages and the people who are dependent on the land, unquote. Yunus regards the ruling as a continuation of the Nakba, the 1948 ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Yunus has said, history repeats itself, Nakba after Nakba. This helped throw into focus how a major injustice has become entrenched. British-born Mentz wields total life divesting power over those who are indigenous to the land.
and through, the Zionist regime weaponizes interminency, an unresolved preponderance of settlers and settlements, really, colonizers and colonies, undeclared borders, de facto annexation against the indigenous population. The Zionist regime's main imperative is to displace no matter the cost. This is why the families of Masafer Yatan need to prove that their home is their home, and why this ostensibly simple, even mundane truth can be so arrogantly delegitimized by the labyrinthine logics of settler colonial law. Yunus Wurtz also capture in exacting detail how the struggle of Palestinians in Masafer Yatta illuminates the overall anti-colonial character of the Palestinian resistance struggle as a whole, Nakba after Nakba, so long as Zionism, the Zionist regime's ideology, exists, it will continue to mean an alternating dance between colonial violence and the reactionary settler laws that justify it. And of course, there is the settler, the glorified squatter, the would-be colonizer fully supported and enabled by the fake regime of Israel, which in turn was founded by and is sustained through the very acts of violent theft, appropriation and racist dehumanization of this figure represents. What began as an apparent exception is inevitably codified into general policy by a settler colonial regime. Organizers and activists remain acutely aware that there is an added layer of cruelty in addition to the colonial process of expulsion from Masafer Yatta. As activist Hamdan Muhammad Al-Horaini has explained, it's not really about destroying the houses, it's about destroying the life. If the area can be entirely depopulated, the time during which Palestinians lived there can in turn be erased. This allows the Zionist regime's colonial repurposing to eventually be confirmed by a surface reality made possible by ethnic cleansing. Then there will be no sense of time, no possibility of history outside of the colonizer's claims. Indeed, to be Palestinian living in the extended present of ongoing Zionist settler colonialism means confronting time on many levels and in many ways. First, naturally, it means to continue finding oneself racing against time, as the Zionist regime and its military steal more land, prolong an inhuman blockade, raise more homes, and continue to execute, detain, and incarcerate Palestinians, fracturing intimate timelines of kith and kin. It also means to have colonial history weaponized against you as procedures and conventions set into place by a violent settler regime become their own repetitive reference points, justifying Palestinian dehumanization and dispossession. The ongoing struggle to save Masafer Yatta encompasses all of this. But the story of Masafer Yatta is not just the greater story of Palestinian dispossession. It is also the greater narrative of Palestinian resistance. The entire regime of Israel can't remove me. We will not leave. We will not get out of here because we are the inhabitants of the land, Palestinian farmer Khaled al-Jabarin has declared. The phrase Nakba after Nakba reminds us the Nakba was not a moment in time. It is an ongoing process, a process against which Palestinians continue to rise up. This is a phenomenon as the ongoing repression and resistance in Al-Quds Sheikh Jarrah, in Gaza and beyond. The Unity Intifada of 2021 showed the world that Palestinians are rising up together regardless of location. This is why we must not only support the call to save Masafer Yatta in as many ways as possible. We must also see the fight to save Masafer Yatta as connected to the larger battle for defeating the Zionist settler colonialism and to free Palestine from the river to the sea.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.